Evening, everybody. The Chicago newspapers have been gloating a bit about what they believe to be the failure of the New York World Fair to be quite as successful as it is.
Attendance and the probable financial loss for the underwriters. This they contrast with the outstanding success of the Chicago Fair. Today's Chicago Daily News carries the first page article with the lugubrious headline, Fair in New York Closing with Huge Loss. Of course, it's hard for a patriotic New Yorker to remain silent under such conditions, even though he does happen to be Chicago's guest at the moment. Now, if anyone had cast up the financial balance of the Chicago Fair at the end of the first season, it would certainly have looked like a big financial flop. And New York's fair, located on the Atlantic seaboard and charging 75 cents, will pull in 26 million people the first year against Chicago's 22 million. And Chicago is in the center of the United States and only charged 50 cents admission. Moreover, the Chicago fair came in a period of slow recovery, while New York's came in a period of constant international tension and European war. Chicago's Century of Progress Exposition was certainly a great local fair, but New York's is a great world's fair. Last Sunday is the first time I had a chance to spend the better part of a day at our fair, and I was again enthralled. The exhibition of old masters is unrivaled by any museum in Europe. The Futurama of General Motors is a superb piece of imaginative creation. Perhaps some of my listeners haven't seen our fair. Well, don't miss it. Following Chicago's good example, we've now reduced the price of admission to 50 cents. The fair will run two more weeks this year, as well as next summer. Chicago taught us that this is the way to make up the inevitable first-year deficit. And here's hoping that when Grover Whalen gets out of the red, the newspaper boys of the second city in the United States will give the first city of the United States a happier headline than it got today. There were hints from Germany early today that there is to be no attack on France or Britain, but Germany is ready for peace. It was said that the annexation of those parts of Poland which once belonged to Germany is intended to indicate that a Polish state of 50,000 square miles, inhabited by some 20 million Poles, is to be recreated. German troops, we are told, have orders not to enter France, and German aviators have orders not to go beyond the British coast. And suddenly tonight, all this peace talk evaporates. Germany takes up the gauntlet where Britain and France threw it down, and there will be a war to the finish on the Western Front. So says an official statement tonight from Berlin, in angry denial of these reports that Führer Adolf Hitler is contemplating a new peace offer. The official DNB, that's the Deutsches Nachrichtenbüro agency, described as absurd reports that Hitler plans to make a new peace offer to the French, possibly through a third power, after having halted his armies at the French frontier. The situation needs no further clarification, said the DNB statement. England and France rejected the Führer's hand of peace. They threw down the gauntlet. Germany has taken it up. To claim to see a peace offensive is completely absurd. Now, what this suggests is that there is a definite peace faction somewhere in the German government or, and this is important, in the German army. The foreign press correspondents don't take the peace talk they featured earlier today out of thin air. They get it from some press official. Who gets it? From a higher up. All their stuff is censored. When they talk peace over the radio or over the cables, someone in Germany wants them to talk peace and lets them talk peace. The same thing happened about 2 weeks ago when the peace offensive was at its height. Siegfried Schultz, the able Berlin correspondent of the Chicago Tribune, sent a story that amazed most students of the war when they saw it in that newspaper. The German censor permitted her to talk about a split in the Nazi party, about the shortage of food and raw materials in Germany, and about the fact that the Allies would soon have superiority in the air. All this was just to prove that the Germans were sincere in wanting peace. What this shows
is that there is a peace party in Germany. The news of the Turkish-British treaty will strengthen that party. Allied propaganda will do its best to strengthen it still more. The Germans have always insisted that Allied propaganda plus the Allied blockade defeated them in the last war. Der Stoß im Rücken, the Nazis call it, the stab in the back. History may repeat itself. Colonel Lindbergh seems to have been as unfortunate in his second radio speech on neutrality as he was fortunate in his first. His first appeal struck a sincere patriotic note. Its whole effort was to keep America out of war. The speaker took no partisan position on the embargo and made an evident effort to be entirely nonpartisan. The speech was so successful in its appeal to American public opinion that the colonel was persuaded to try again. The second speech had a very mixed reception. It offended patriotic Canadians, while reaction in the United States was not particularly favorable. Today, Senator Brown of Michigan tried to square things with our good neighbors at the North by telling Canadians that Colonel Lindbergh did not speak for America. Here is the Lindbergh sentence that caused all the commotion. Quote, "Can we rightfully permit any country in America to give bases to foreign warships or to send its army abroad to fight while it remains secure in our protection at home? Sooner or later, we must demand the freedom of this continent and its surrounding islands from the dictates of European powers." End quote. And here is Senator Brown's oratorical reply this afternoon. Quote, "Colonel Lindbergh's statement as to the right of the United States to deny Canada control of its affairs, specifically to prevent it from sending an army abroad, his unasked advice that the connection with Great Britain be cut is not only a gratuitous insult to a sister nation, but it is based on a wholly erroneous concept of our continental American policy. I condemn his remarks because they lend encouragement to the spirit of nationalistic imperialism that has cursed the world for centuries and which is the potent poison that has killed peace. I would have the world know that he did not speak for America." Thus orates United States Senator Brown. Now, if Colonel Lindbergh had said what he did say in time of peace, he might have started an interesting but unimpassioned argument. After all, President Roosevelt has definitely said that we would not stand idly by and see Canada attacked. Canada has now gone to war and is subject to attack. If we defend Canada, we too may get into war. Therefore, since Canada's war may become our war, have we any right to try and persuade her to keep out of war? Perhaps Canada's answer would be, "Well, we haven't asked you to defend us yet." The news from Turkey is the dominating news of the war. Turkey's specific treaty with Britain and with France means that there is a complete change in the war situation so far as the Mediterranean is concerned. It means that tremendous political pressure has been put upon Italy to stay out of the war. It means that the hands of France and Britain have been strengthened immeasurably throughout the Balkan states. And the reaction is quite natural. The British press features this treaty as beyond anything that has happened since the war began. The London Times says the pact is decisive for maintaining peace in the Mediterranean. It strengthens the small states in southeastern Europe. It is regarded as a defeat for Germany. The Berlin Nazi press says that Turkey is now a vassal to British interests, that Turkey can no longer be classed as neutral, that Turkey's best interests have been lost, have been sacrificed, that England cannot help Turkey. And German officials say this recalls the fate of Poland. The Nazis see the treaty as giving Britain that control of the Dardanelles for which she fought in vain during the World War. And Berlin thinks the treaty may help bring on a general war and suggests that it may bring about cooperation between Russia and Italy. That, of course, very much remains to be seen. Paris points out that now, if Italy enters the war on the side of Germany, it means that Turkey lines up with France and Britain. The French see the pact as a major diplomatic victory for the Allies. It strengthens, they say, the military ring around Germany. Turkey sees it as a pact to help small Balkan states against big power aggression. The Turks insist that the treaty does not affect Turkish-Russian relations. And that is important because specifically the pact provides, quote, it cannot compel Turkey to action having as its effect or involving as its consequence entry into armed conflict with the USSR, end quote. That means that Russia is still free to act in the Balkans without Turkey being obliged to come to the aid of France and Britain against Russia. United States Ambassador Joseph C. Grew has thrown a verbal bombshell at the Japanese by telling them the truth. Upon returning to his post in Tokyo from a stay in the United States, he made a public speech. He was expected to voice the usual polite amenities. An ambassador was once described as a man sent to lie abroad for his country. Most of them do. Ambassador Grew didn't. He told his super polite Japanese hosts that Americans don't like the way Japan's militarists are acting in China. He said, the American people regard with growing seriousness the violation and interference with American rights by Japanese armed forces in China in disregard of treaties and agreements. Between nations, as between individuals, there are times when a true friend must speak the blunt truth. Good night.